and know that I too do not want to turn back the clock when it comes to women's reproductive rights.
Senator Murkowski hears from Alaskans as she considers the president's Supreme Court nominee. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 31st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, dozens of National Guard armories across the state are being refitted for their local communities.
So our goal is to get them off our books and get them into the hands of an organization that can make better use of them than we are right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Lisa Murkowski isn't ready to say yet how she'll vote on President Trump's latest Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. The senator who might cast the decisive vote on this lifetime appointment says she's reading Kavanaugh's decisions and wants to hear from her constituents. And last night, really only one side weighed in. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin explores the political stakes for Murkowski.
The Senate schedule will keep Murkowski in D.C. most of August, so she experimented with a new way to reach her constituents, an online and telephonic town hall. Hundreds of people took part. A dozen got to ask questions. And a funny thing happened. Alaska is a red state, but not one person asked her to vote for Kavanaugh.
Why should Donald Trump be allowed to appoint a Supreme Court justice at this time?
Concerned about Judge Kavanaugh's approach.
I'm concerned about Judge Kavanaugh's support for the unified executive.
I have very deep concerns about judicial nominee of Kavanaugh. I'm very, very much concerned about Roe v. Wade.
Murkowski told them she heard their concerns.
And know that I, too, do not want to turn back the clock when it comes to women's reproductive rights. I do not want to see Roe v. Wade overturned.
There's no reason to believe this was a representative sample of Alaskans. The pool was a self-selected group that chose to spend an hour on the line with their U.S. senator. But the Alaskans who got to ask questions were chosen more or less randomly from that pool. They were not screened by subject matter. At the Capitol the next day, Murkowski said the hundreds of listeners likely represented a range of views, but it was striking to her that most, if not all, of the dozen who asked questions were opposed to the president's agenda.
I don't know why. Perhaps it's, you know, if you are worried or concerned about something, you are more apt to weigh in publicly.
What Murkowski thinks of Kavanaugh matters. She's one of the few moderate Republicans who sometimes bucks her party. If she and all the Democrats vote no, it would sink the nomination. So the stakes are high. Still, Alaska conservatives aren't too worried. So says conservative talk show host Dave Stearin, who has a show on KFQD. Stearin says most of his conservative callers voted for Trump because of his potential Supreme Court picks. But Murkowski's lack of an announced position isn't ruffling their feathers.
I have not gotten 20 callers in a row saying, Lisa Murkowski better vote for Kavanaugh. I don't think they have a sense that she's terribly opposed to him.
As Stearin sees it, Murkowski supports the causes of her Democratic constituents so often she could easily vote to confirm Kavanaugh without paying any political price for it.
They need her more than she needs them. So you're angry at me. Boo-hoo. Look at my track record of voting to support you. And if I wanted to run and win again, I would run and win again. Where are you going to go?
Alaska Republican Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock says he's not hearing a ton of concern about Murkowski's vote on Kavanaugh either. He believes Alaska Republicans think she'll come around to confirm the nominee, even if it takes a while.
This is very much how she conducts herself. It's not a surprise, and she's very deliberative about these nominations, and she's being very deliberative about this one.
But Babcock says if Murkowski votes against Kavanaugh on philosophical grounds to try to preserve Roe v. Wade, the political cost to her would be dramatic. He says Murkowski has been clear that she supports the landmark court decision protecting abortion. Babcock says Alaska Republicans know that and have reelected her anyway.
But if she turns down a nominee solely because of one political issue, I think that would be very difficult for most Republicans to accept.
The chair of Alaska's Democratic Party, Casey Steinau, says Alaska women who support reproductive rights will hold Murkowski to account if she doesn't turn down the nominee.
I think if she goes ahead and supports Kavanaugh, like I said, I think she is just throwing the support of women, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, all across the board, just throwing their support in the garbage and saying, I don't care what you think anymore, and I've changed my mind. I think it's a very strong signal.
Murkowski says she's reading all of Brett Kavanaugh's decisions and speeches to prepare for her meeting with him so she can form her own opinion. Her impression so far? Murkowski says he's a learned man and a good writer. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The state of Alaska is offering companies a sneak preview on some of the land it's offering at this year's oil and gas lease sale. In exchange for tax credits, oil companies released data to the state, data they collected while looking for oil in three different areas on the North Slope. The state is now offering this information to other oil companies for a fee. And this year, it's putting the three areas up for bid at the state's annual lease sale. Companies have looked for oil in these areas before, but Kevin Frank, a petroleum geologist for the state, says some recent oil discoveries in Alaska were in places other companies explored in the past.
There are things that are still out there. There's still discoveries being announced, and that's part of the excitement right now, is the discoveries that are announced are in areas that have been looked at over and over and over again.
Department of Natural Resources Deputy Commissioner Mark Wiggins says he hopes it attracts new oil companies to Alaska.
What would be a really fabulous outcome is if we would even incentivize or motivate additional explorers to come in and take a look.
The three areas up for bid total about 120,000 acres. One encompasses land and waters north of Prudhoe Bay, another just south of Prudhoe Bay. The third is in Harrison Bay, east of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. And full disclosure, Mark Wiggin is also a member of the Alaska Public Media Board of Directors. Residents of Nome continue to wait to access high-speed internet through Quintillion's fiber optic cable, though a handful of business customers are now connecting to it. One of those business customers is the University of Alaska Fairbanks Northwest Campus. Director Bob Metcalf says it's an upgrade for administrative staff who have to exchange a lot of information with the main campus in Fairbanks.
Whereas sometimes they'd have to wait for screens to refresh and be ready for the next entry, it was a lot quicker.
He says he's hopeful the fiber optic internet will make it easier to connect to UAF teleconferences and events around the state. But he says video streaming still isn't that much quicker. And Metcalf says they're also conscious that the campus serves a lot of people outside of Nome who still don't have great internet access.
Still a lot of our students and a lot of our communities that do rely on the old satellite connections or, you know, now it's a cell service, that we're still staying connected with them and provide access that they can actually use. So we don't want to leave anyone behind.
Other organizations that are getting access to Quintillion's cable through third-party providers include the City of Nome, Nome Public Schools, and Kowarik. But until negotiations about residential service are completed, non-disclosure agreements often keep both Quintillion and the providers from releasing any information about a possible timeline for residents to see service turned on. Christina Woolston is Quintillion's Vice President for External Relations. She would not give specifics about any talks Quintillion is having with providers.
Every community is unique and every provider is unique, and I can't speak to the nature of the conversations that we've had with providers, but we're getting close.
None of the big telecommunications companies in Nome, GCI, TelAlaska, Alaska Communication Systems, would disclose any plans about residential service or even confirm that negotiations are happening. Quintillion says it's also looking at expanding the cable into a handful of additional Western Alaska communities, but in Nome, residents will keep waiting to get connected. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau nonprofit is asking for more funds for its solution to homelessness.
You can support housing first because you realize that it makes economic sense, or you can support it because you think it's the right thing to do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A man died on the Davidson Glacier River near Haines after a canoe carrying 11 people capsized Monday. U.S. Coast Guard spokesperson Meredith Manning says the canoe was part of a guided tour of Glacier Point for passengers from three different cruise ships. 10 people reportedly went through rapids on the glacial-fed river. Juneau-based state troopers coordinated a response with the tour operator, Alaska Excursions. A Coast Guard helicopter bound for Skagway was immediately diverted to the scene. 50-year-old Stephen Todd Willis of North Las Vegas was found deceased in the water. The remaining passengers were safely rescued and transferred to a small boat. The Coast Guard transported Willis's remains to Juneau by helicopter, where they were released to the next of kin who had also been passengers on the tour. River conditions were reported to be higher than usual at the time of the canoe tour, and an investigation is ongoing. Across Alaska, dozens of buildings have been sitting vacant for about a decade. They are Alaska Army National Guard armories built during the Cold War years to monitor any suspicious activity from the nearby Soviet Union. Half of these armories sit in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. These relics have become liabilities to the military, and KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports the state government wants to hand them over to local communities.
In Tentatuliak, the Native Village Corporation is now using its old armory for hardware storage. In Napakiak, the city is renovating its armory into a community multipurpose building. 26 more communities in the YK Delta will soon make the decision about how to use their local armory.
They're not necessarily large, maybe 1,200 to 1,800 square feet. Wood construction, metal roof, probably metal siding. Heating fuel tank on the outside.
Brian Duffy is with the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. With the Cold War long over and Alaska Army National Guard recruitment plummeting, the old armories aren't needed to conduct surveillance as they were in the past.
What you would have were pockets of people that served to look, see, feel, hear things in their communities that were different and report back.
The department will not reap significant savings on maintenance or utilities by transferring these buildings.
But what we are going to do is avoid what's becoming, to a greater extent, a liability for the department and the community where you've got a building that's sat vacant for some time.
Such buildings can attract unwanted activity, but so far, this has been more of a risk than an actual problem.
But the longer they stay vacant, the greater their opportunity is. And so our goal is to get them off our books and get them into the hands of an organization that can make better use of them than we are right now.
That's any entity in the community that wants to accept the building. That is, if a federal agency doesn't also want it. There's no exchange of funds, but there is paperwork, and Duffy encourages interested parties to get started early. He suggests communities contact the Bureau of Indian Affairs or the General Services Administration of the federal government. The goal is to divest more than 60 armories across the state over the next 4 years. Each site will be inspected for pollutants, and any site found to be contaminated or unclaimed by a community will be demolished. Some armories in the YK Delta will be kept by the military as facilities to train and store equipment. These armories include Bethel, Hooper Bay, Kipnuk, Kweethuk, and Quinnahock. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
In Bristol Bay, commercial fishing in the Nooshigak District reopened at 4 p.m. this afternoon. It had been closed to salmon fishing for nearly a week because a 58-foot vessel sank near Clark's Point and was leaking fuel. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Area management biologist Tim Sands has been monitoring the situation by air. He flew an aerial survey Tuesday morning.
We basically flew down to the wreck site and we saw no fuel coming out, no sign of any sheen anywhere.
Sands added that fishermen on the district's beaches reported they also did not see or smell fuel on the water. Even though the district's sockeye run is tailing off, Sands said there is still significant interest in fishing for pink, coho, and the remaining red salmon. At least three major processors are still buying.
I'm getting calls from people saying they want to go. So, five or six calls, how many people that represents, I don't know, but definitely there's people who want to fish.
The owner of the vessel is contracting with the private company Resolve Marine on salvage efforts for the 58-foot vessel. Todd Duke is Resolve Marine's Alaska area manager.
Right now, we are actually in a fuel removal process. So we are have divers that are working on the vessel, and they're doing a couple of things. They're pumping the remaining fuel off the vessel, and then they're also sealing vents. They're utilizing a couple of different techniques to seal those up in order to keep any residual fuel from leaking out.
Duke said the salvage team is also conducting surveys to better understand how the vessel is situated on the riverbed. He said that low visibility and strong tidal current has slowed divers' efforts. When the Pacific Knight sank, it was carrying over 1,000 gallons of fuel. Duke said that some of that still remains on the vessel and that divers have removed a substantial amount, but could not provide a specific figure. After the remaining fuel is pumped off, the owner and insurance company will decide whether or not to remove the sunk boat. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
Housing First is a model that creates permanent supportive housing for the homeless. Last fall, a Juneau nonprofit built a 32-unit Housing First apartment complex to serve the community's most vulnerable residents. As KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports, Juneau's elected officials are being asked for a multi-million-dollar commitment to more than double the facility's capacity.
Mark Mergenthal was discharged from the Army in 2010. After that, the 37-year-old self-described homeless alcoholic said he was constantly on edge.
Living out on the streets at Juneau was just like being back in Afghanistan or Iraq, other than the fact that I didn't have my rifle.
Court records show at least 30 arrests in Juneau since 2011. Most of them were for public drinking, littering, illegal camping, and other petty offenses. Then he moved into Housing First.
It's very nice to be able to, you know, when I'm hungry, get up and cook something.
Court records show his last arrest was in October, the month before he moved in. Researchers at University of Alaska Southeast have been tracking residents like Mergenthal. Over 6 months, the residents' contacts with police dropped by more than 70%. Ambulance trips to the ER also fell considerably.
You can support Housing First because you realize that it makes economic sense, or you can support it because you think it's the right thing to do.
Bruce Denton is on Juneau's Housing First board of directors. He's also a downtown merchant who's been on the front lines of the debate over what to do about homeless alcoholics, panhandling, and camping out.
And you got the folks on one side that say, by gosh, we should take care of all these people. It doesn't matter what it costs. It's our moral obligation. You got the folks clear over on the other side of the spectrum that say, why the hell should I, you know, enable a drunk? And as you begin to share the commonality, you get to the point where those two circles of population come together, and that's where Housing First is.
Residents pay a third of their income toward rent. That includes any wages, public assistance benefits, and permanent fund dividend checks. Any shareholder dividends from Native corporations also help. Housing First isn't a halfway house. There are no mandatory rehab programs or curfews, but there is an on-site medical clinic and counseling services available.
When everyone moved in the beginning, there were definitely challenges in regards to helping tenants adjust to a new way of life.
Dasha Davis has been the on-site manager since it opened last September.
But things have really settled down. People are in a routine. People feel comfortable. They've built relationships with staff and now are going out more on their own in the community.
Nine of the residents are women. Among the first wave was 48-year-old Mary Bailey. She's also a self-described alcoholic, but said much of her drinking was to cope with the misery of being homeless.
I was sober for a couple weeks. I drank a couple days ago, and it was just a few drinks that night, and I sobered up the next day. If I were out on the street, I would have woke up that next day. Someone would have came over and was like, hey, what are you doing, Mary? You know, it's right there in your face. You know, here you could lock the door.
There are at least 94 people on the waiting list to get a place at Housing First. Now, the nonprofit board wants to whittle it down by building 45 new single apartments. There is state and federal funding available, but the city is being asked for a $4.2 million commitment. There's a hard deadline in early October to take advantage of funding from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and others.
It would be critical for Juneau to secure those funds.
Maria Lovishuk is one of Housing First's top administrators. She'll be making a pitch to the Juneau Assembly. After Juneau taps into grant funding, she said the city's actual cost would be around $1.5 million. She says it's something she wants people to start talking about.
But October 5th is coming, and it's really urgent. And if we don't come up with anything, we will not be able to build phase two.
The city already contributed more than $2 million towards the first phase. It'll be up to the assembly whether the city should double down on its investment in the Housing First model to help tackle Juneau's homeless problem. Those discussions are expected to begin in August. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The Folk School of Fairbanks has a new home at Pioneer Park. The nonprofit school's board of directors hope they'll attract more students and offer more classes on traditional crafts and outdoor skills in the two buildings they moved into over the past couple of weeks. KUAC's Tim Ellis took a tour of the school's new facilities and has this report.
Back through here, we've got a small kitchen.
The old cabin that'll house the Folk School's offices and a classroom or two is a bit rough around the edges, but board president Gordon Williams says it's the perfect place for the school, which for 15 years has offered hands-on instruction on such traditional skills as woodworking and gardening, along with some 21st century sustainability classes on subjects like recycling.
It's a prime location. I mean, it's right next to the Nanana and Centennial Hall. People walking by to go use the playgrounds and stuff walk right by here all the time. So from our standpoint, it's a great location.
Williams says the cabin next to the riverboat Nanana and another nearby building both are located much more conveniently than the big cabin on Beverly Lane off Goldstream Road that the school's been operating out of for nearly 4 years.
It wasn't great, for example, if you want to have like an after-school program for kids because parents want to be able to drop the kids off, go get a coffee, run an errand, come back. Sure. And then that far out, that's not really going to work for an hour and a half class.
Williams says the Folk School should have much greater visibility in Pioneer Park, and he hopes to attract some of the people who go there with activities it'll offer at the cabin and the wood shop, located a couple hundred feet away near the Golden Dome Aviation Museum. He says the school will hold classes in the shop like woodworking, open to people of all skill levels.
And there's classes on, you know, care and maintenance and use of chisels. And then there's more advanced things. I mean, we'll offer classes in boat making and building. There's a class about how to build your own pack raft.
On the walk across the playground to the wood shop, Williams says he hopes the new location also will enable the school to strengthen its relationship with partner organizations that include the Alaska Songbird Institute and Calypso Farm.
We're members of both Explore Fairbanks and the Arts Association, and both of those operate here in the park. And so being able to develop a closer and more active relationship with them, I think, is also going to be helpful for us. Yeah, go on in. It's going to be a little bit echoey. Get some lights on for you here.
The light reveals a big shop with power tools and workbenches lined up against the wall waiting to be set up. And it's immediately clear that both Williams and Don Kiley, the school's operation director who tagged along for the tour, are excited about putting all that space to good use.
It's also quite a bit larger than the wood shop that we had at Beverly Lane as well.
Yeah, so twice the square footage. So that's going to be a huge improvement for us.
Williams says the bigger shop will be great for teaching students how to build such handiwork as traditional birch bark canoes and functional furniture, like the Sand County Almanac chair, inspired by Aldo Leopold's seminal work.
There's something special about when you bring people who are passionate about something they know together with people who are passionate to learn it.
Kylie, a longtime Folk School volunteer and supporter, says that passion comes from believing in the school and the instruction that it offers.
It's such a wonderful organization to be a part of. You know, just the energy and the positiveness, and people are so excited to be doing what they're doing or teaching what they're teaching. And, you know, just it overflows with good karma.
Folk School staff could use some good karma and maybe some volunteer help in getting their new digs set up before they celebrate their opening with an official ribbon cutting in a couple of weeks, with classes beginning soon thereafter. This fall's lineup includes courses on designing floral bouquets and how to butcher a chicken. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Reindeer herding is becoming an increasingly attractive economic option for communities in the Norton Sound region. As winter sea ice cover becomes more unreliable, the traditional practice of hunting for marine mammals is more dangerous. Some community leaders hope reindeer herds, originally imported from Scandinavia in the late 19th century, could now fill a growing gap in ensuring economic security. KNOM's Gabe Colombo has the story of three Norton Sound communities working to expand their operations.
I hope it opens.
I'm about to step inside a mobile reindeer processing plant in Savunga with Richmond Tooley, the chief herder of St. Lawrence Island's 4,000 to 5,000 reindeer.
My Uncle Herman, I followed him when I was a teenager. And he taught me everything while he was a chief herder. I enjoy doing it. I love it. I go out there and drive around all around the island.
The plant is basically two big trailers with equipment inside to store, cool, hang, and butcher 16 reindeer at a time.
Before we batch them, we cut them in half right here with this one, like a chainsaw. We had one, cut them right in the middle. We got orders from all over Alaska and Washington.
Those orders and others from as far away as Australia have convinced Savunga Tribal Chief Delbert Pungawi that the demand for commercial meat is there.
To us, that's the only real promise that can really bring a huge difference to our people on the island, where we can sustain ourselves and take care of ourselves as our ancestors have, without pleading to Washington or anyone for any funding.
Right now, they're limited to field slaughtering, which Pungawi estimates brings about $1,000 per whole carcass. But butchering it professionally, he thinks, could get at least $1,600 per reindeer.
Really need to get that in motion because of the food security that we're losing from the Bering Sea itself.
Across the Norton Sound in Stebbins, Thomas Kirk feels the same way. He's the clerk for the community's tribal association.
Climate change has affected our sea ice hunting and our marine mammal gathering. The ice is a lot thinner, and having our reindeer is a blessing.
The herd here is estimated to be over 5,000 head, the largest in the Norton Sound region, and it's jointly owned by the native villages of Stebbins and St. Michael and the chief reindeer herder, Theodore Kachak. The group is already selling antlers commercially to a buyer from California at $25 a pound.
I also have other interests in the Asian market that would like to purchase the reindeer horns and the meat. Eastern Asia, China, Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan.
Pungawi envisions a coalition of reindeer herding tribes around Norton Sound that could sell meat collectively. It's something the Regional Reindeer Herders Association has discussed.
If we did it right, we could become the Alaska's reindeer capital, the Bering Sea region.
From Savunga's shoreline, the bright blue water stretches as far as the eye can see on a sunny July day. As late as 1975, though, you might have seen some sea ice here at this time of the year. Now, solid sea ice isn't a guarantee, even in March. But if Thule, Kirk, Kachak, and Pungawi see their vision of a reindeer economy made real, a more solid guarantee of self-sustenance might be on the horizon. Reporting in Western Alaska, I'm Gabe Colombo.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Henry Leisha in Haines, Gabe Colombo in Nome, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, and Jacob Resnick in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.